it's episode 3! On today's episode, we are taking an academic look at the Victorian age in Sherlock Holmes with our special guest Trudy from the Baker Street Supper Club. We also are going to have a major Granada geek out, so if you're a big fan of the Granada series, or if you know nothing about it, like me, you can listen along and enjoy. We're going to talk about favorite episodes, favorite moments, and why the Granada series is really quite important to Sherlock Holmes fandom. Afterwards, pay attention for the news, the next installment of Kaffir's Reading Corner, and a new song by Caitlin Obam. I hope you enjoy.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1?
And welcome to episode 3 of the Big Street Babes podcast. Yay!
Yay!
So this time we are joined by a new babe. We're here with Jen.
Wow, that was one hell of a greeting. Thank you.
We're here with Jen.
Welcome to the Big Street Babes.
Yeah, welcome, finally.
Yay. Thanks. Well, you know, there's a 5-hour difference and everything, so.
Yeah. Jen is also American. So, yay, I'm not the only one anymore.
I'm sorry, did my accent give that away?
No. No, I never would have known, maybe. Actually. I never would have guessed that you were American.
Yeah.
And also, our special guest is Trudy, who is our history. Why are you waving? No one can see you.
Well, we can imagine her waving. Imagine everyone. Trudy is waving to you now.
So because we have like the standard formula now, I'm just going to ask it to everyone. So Jen.
Yes.
How did you get into Sherlock Holmes? What is your favorite character? What is your favorite story? And what is your favorite adaptation?
Oh boy. I got into Sherlock Holmes with the BBC version that just came out. I think that's how I was introduced. I mean, obviously I had known who Sherlock Holmes was for quite some time, but I had never read any of his stories growing up. Oh God, I've just forgotten the second question.
Your favorite character.
Oh, well, it's Lestrade. I love Lestrade. I think he's a really great character. I think he's a very underrated character too. I think so many people think he's, you know, some bumbling idiot, and he really isn't. I mean, he's a smart guy, and if he wasn't smart, Sherlock wouldn't want to work with him every time. So my favorite story, I think that's the third one.
Yes.
Hound of the Baskervilles is my favorite story. And it's probably because it's the last one I read. I finished it a couple of weeks ago. So, and then my favorite adaptation, it's a toss up right now. Because yeah. I've been watching the Granada series, and but it's a toss-up between the Granada series and the recent BBC version.
Good, good.
I know how you feel.
But it is, it's, I mean, the Granada version is just so great because it's the actual, you know, Victorian period, so you feel like you're in one of Conan Doyle's stories, which is kind of cool.
Okay, Trudy, I'm going to ask you the same questions.
You're going to have to repeat them because I've forgotten them.
And if you don't notice, Trudy is also British. So now Catherine isn't alone. Catherine isn't alone.
It's fine. Most people could guess that Catherine is short for Catherine.
Yeah, I said I'm forever alone.
You are forever alone. Well, Maria was here last time.
Forever alone. Yes. I'm playing the smallest violin in the world for you right now.
Aww.
Aww.
I was going to say, it's almost like a Sherlock Holmes reference playing a violin.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a silence. A carefully constructed joke. You all.
Okay, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes, Judy?
I got into Sherlock Holmes thanks to my mother, who was a huge fan of detective fiction. So I grew up reading Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. My favourite character has to be Sherlock Holmes.
Yay!
Simply because I love the way that he observes things, the way that he looks at a crime scene or at a person and just observes the minute things that people very often don't see. I love that in him. Favourite adaptation was the next one?
Favourite story, but first I just want to say, she has like this most glorious smile on her face. It's like she's like completely in love. It's pretty funny.
Favourite story is a tough one because it depends on whether I'm reading the books or watching a TV programme.
Let's go with the books.
Then it's going to have to be The Hound of the Baskervilles, so I'm going to have to agree with Jen on that one. Favourite adaptation would be the Granada series. Sorry, I'm just going to about to get slapped by all the Sherlock 2010 fans.
Like in our first one. Like,
absolutely not. Opinion,
I love that series for Jeremy Brett because he was just such an amazing actor and he just lived and breathed Sherlock Holmes. It was amazing. And my favourite story from the Granada series would have to be The Adventure at the Priory School. Because the way he acted.
That was a good one.
The way he portrayed his compassion and his understanding for the little boy who'd gone missing was just incredible. And I love it.
Story of that. I just remembered, I've read the story of that, but I've not seen the Granada episode for it yet. Be an interesting comparison.
Yeah, you really need to watch it, because Jeremy Brett's acting in that is just amazing.
It is really, really good.
We can talk more about the Granada series later, but first, the reason she is here is because she's a super historical lady.
Does that mean I have to wear my pants out?
That was the most wonderful introduction I've ever heard, Curly.
I'm so good at introducing people. I don't know if you guys have noticed yet.
Continue as you were.
So, Trudy, you've done tons of historical, like, just on your own, like, research and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you love Sherlock Holmes and you love the whole Victorian atmosphere. So what kind of got you into that?
What got me into Victorian history?
Yeah.
Probably a combination of books like Sherlock Holmes and other ones like Dracula and 19th century authors, people like M.R. James and Sheridan Le Fanu, and then watching a lot of the History Channel.
yes. Many sick days off school I should watch that channel.
So watching things like the documentaries that Fred Dibner did about steam engines and the Victorian pharmacy, all those kind of things, it just it's a period that I find fascinating.
Why do you think Arthur Conan Doyle chose Baker Street? And what was Baker Street, what was the surrounding area sort of seen as in the Victorian times?
I'm not quite sure why Conan Doyle chose Baker Street for Sherlock's residence. The one thing that Baker Street has is a great mix of different classes of people. So the street actually forms part of the borough of Marylebone, or Marylebone, or...
Marylebone.
Which country you come from?
Well, we could do a little bit of entomology there, everybody.
which really grew up north of Oxford Street during the 18th century, but it surrounds and gets its name from the village of Marylebone. Those suburbs were originally constructed really to allow the well-to-do middle classes and the merchant class to move out of the old medieval city of London. That old medieval city had become extremely overcrowded. It was rife with disease. It stank to high heaven. The narrow streets and the wooden buildings just constituted one heck of a fire risk. The newly rich, during the Industrial Revolution and the expansion of the British Empire, decided that they were going to move out into the rural areas, which constitute the West End today. The East End was already taken up with the dockyards, so that wasn't an option. So they all moved sort of from Holborn down towards Hyde Park. And that part of the town developed out of what was essentially farm fields and orchards. The village of Marylebone was already in existence, and it had its own church, it had its own high street, and it also had a rather large workhouse and cemetery. And that workhouse and cemetery remained pretty much in operation throughout the 19th century, although the cemetery closed down in the 1850s, I think. Those streets were developed in a Georgian style, so they were laid out in the 18th century. They follow similar lines to the way that American cities were laid out during the same time, in that the streets tend to be wide. They all have right-angled corners as much as possible. And you get little squares and private gardens where the well-to-do middle classes can go out and socialise and flirt with each other and...
As you do.
But you've still got on Baker Street, you've still got this huge concentration of people who are absolutely desperately poor. So the upper section of what is now Baker Street, but which was then York Place, was entirely given over to this workhouse. So I think in terms of that area of London, it was in a way quite unique for its mixture of different classes.
I didn't really realize that it was like that drastic of changes like in class and everything, which is very interesting. Everyone rummaging around together. Mm. The fancy traps and then diseased little boys.
Well, it was interesting.
Sounds delightful, really.
It would be interesting to look into it more in terms of where Arthur Conan Doyle got the idea for the Baker Street Irregulars from.
Yeah.
Because they were obviously street children.
Whether
or not he got the idea that they came from the workhouse or whether they came from somewhere else. I mean, certainly there were plenty of workhouses in London. There was another one further to the east towards Holborn. And there was also what were called the Rookeries of St. Giles, which was down at the other end of Oxford Street, which was a notorious Victorian slum. It was so bad that the police would often not go in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pulled
down. Oh dear.
That was demolished.
That sounds like the perfect place that Sherlock Holmes would probably go, just like to solve a mystery. He'd be like, right, I'm off. And the police are like, yeah, off you go.
And he would probably go in disguise as well, I would imagine. If he went in his normal clothing, he'd probably
he'd be dressed as like
the mugs within minutes.
He'd probably have like a flat there, you know, dressed as like a chimney sweep, an old man, and he'd have like a horrible little attic that he went to like change his costume. Oh, you know, it he would have done something like that.
See, the moment you say chimney sweep, I can only think of like Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins.
Don't start that.
The image I always get when I think of the Rookeries is Fagin, from Oliver Twist, because it's that sort of, those sort of closely knit wooden tenement buildings with the garrets, and you've got like 50 people living in one building and no indoor sanitation stuff whatsoever.
Of course not.
That's a luxury that would be.
Okay, I guess that's a question, I guess, for everyone, because it's been eating away at my brain. What do you think is more indicative of the Victorian era, Charles Dickens or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle? I know there are different parts of the Victorian era, but when people think about it, what do you think they think of more?
I think probably the majority...
Depends what kind of people you ask.
Yeah. I mean, the majority of people, if you said to them, name a Victorian author, probably most people would plump for Charles Dickens before they would plump for Conan Doyle. Possibly.
Yeah, but if you asked for a fictional character that they associate with the Victorian period, I think people would go for Sherlock Holmes.
Well, that's the difference, really, is because the name Sherlock Holmes almost sort of outgrew the author, whereas with Charles Dickens, he churned out so much literature that there are so many names associated with him that he is kind of the first author that you think of when you think of that kind of period. I mean, I think of H.P. Lovecraft, but that's just me. That tells you everything you need to know about me, really.
Right, I think, in a sense, Charles Dickens defined what the Victorian period was for 20th century readers more than Conan Doyle did. Mm. If you think of things like Oliver Twist, yeah, and A Christmas Carol, those are the sort of very stereotypical, iconic images of the Victorian period that we have. You don't necessarily reference Sherlock Holmes when you think about the Victorian period so much.
Good. Okay, that was just my random question.
Okay.
What would Baker Street have looked like in Sherlock Holmes' time? Like, how has it changed in the last century?
Well, Baker Street was laid out by a man called William Baker, and he was employed by the Earl of Oxford, who owned the land and who gives his name to Oxford Street. The houses were Georgian in style, so you had brick-built buildings. They may have had a stucco front on the ground floor, and lights above the doors. You would have had a basement where the kitchens were. Mm-hmm. You would have had a couple of main floors for living on and an attic. If you want to see what Baker Street would have looked like now, the only really place that you can go and see it is if you go to the upper part of Baker Street next to Regent's Park and look at the houses that form the row that the Sherlock Holmes Museum is on, because the rest of the street was pretty extensively bombed during the Second World War. So it lost buildings like Druce's department store, for instance, which was at the southern end of Baker Street, which was an absolutely massive building. I was shocked the first time I saw it on a map. It's huge. And that burnt down during the war. I think it was bombed twice or something like that. And they,
that's just mean.
And they demolished it because it was unsafe. And the rest of the street has pretty much been developed from the 1950s onwards, so there isn't much left of the original Baker Street. Now, the workhouse is gone, for instance. I mean, that operated...
And I would hope so.
That operated...
Thank goodness.
Before that was demolished, and I think they built the London Polytechnic on the site of the old workhouse.
It's a bit like the same thing, really, isn't it?
You say that, in the latter part of its life, it operated as an insane asylum as well.
Well, oh dear.
But I think the main difference, if you invented yourself a little time machine and went back now,
I had to.
Oh dear, she's got a sonic screwdriver out now. The main difference that you would notice, I think, if you went back now, is the difference in smell. In Holmes's time, in the 1950s, the main source of inner city transport, so sort of travelling within London, was still the horse. Mm. So all the streets would have smell of horses and horse manure. There's no way to get around it. And of course, you didn't have internal plumbing either, so people were still using chamber pots. My mum grew up in a house with an outside toilet. So they didn't really come along.
Oh, I know people with outside toilets.
What is wrong with your country?
One of the houses I lived in when I was a student had an outside toilet.
As a student. Oh, that's just terribly inconvenient. Wow. And hungover.
The houses themselves, Mrs. Hudson obviously is Sherlock Holmes' landlady. Mm-hmm. Their setup wouldn't have been that unusual, even in the Georgian Victorian suburbs. Overcrowding was a real issue. There wasn't a lot of space for people. Tenants, lodgers, that sort of thing was fairly normal, probably more normal than it is today, where you have people actually living in with their landlady. You don't get that so much today. Mm. But there would have still been that sort of differentiation between where the servants lived, where the landlady lived, and where the tenants lived. So you've got a lot of people in one house, potentially, and it wouldn't have been that uncommon for housemates to share a bedroom. You're looking aghast at that.
Poker face.
I wasn't going to say anything. I just...
Well, actually, I had a question. Families. Were there multiple families in those homes?
It would depend on how well off you were. If you were living in a tenement, say somewhere like the Rookeries or the old part of London, it's quite possible, mm-hmm, you would have a family, a flaw, or maybe even more.
That rhymed.
There was a study done by, I can't remember the guy's name, but it was the London Labour and the London Poor, I think is the name of the study, which was done in the 19th century by quite a wealthy Londoner who was interested in the working classes. And he went down around and did a survey of all the working class areas of London and found quite often you would get three or four families in one or two rooms in a building, and that building might have four or five rooms in it, so it could be quite overcrowded. You had to be extremely well off to have a single family residence.
I actually know a little bit more about that, because the person who originally started off that movement to find out what was happening in the poor was a man from York, and his name was Sebum Rowntree. If you guys like chocolate, you probably know Rowntree. But they were Quakers, and they were really interested in the plight of the working class, because a lot of those people worked in their chocolate factories. So he did a lot of studying in that, and I think in the records that he did, not for London but for York, there was like one woman who had seven children and like about 10 lodgers living in her house as well. And this is a two-story house, which was so small, it didn't even have a staircase. They used to have to get upstairs with a ladder. So you can imagine, you know, like there used to be a saying, like sort of hanging people on the line, because sometimes they used to hang people on the washing line because there wasn't enough room for them to have a bed. So you can imagine, you know, people just standing up with their arms attached to like a washing line because they couldn't sleep anywhere. Or you'd have as well what was known as a hot bed, because you'd have someone sleeping there at night. They'd get up, and then whoever had come home from doing a night shift would then get into bed, so the bed was always warm. So you can, it's just crazy, like, thinking about how many people used to live in those awful, like, slum houses.
And even in a building where you had a single family living in it, you didn't have the sort of separation that we have today. So, for instance, my mother grew up in a house which was called a two-up, two-down. So you had a kitchen and a lounge downstairs, and then two bedrooms upstairs.
Okay.
No bathroom. And she had seven siblings, so all the girls slept in the same room with the parents, and the boys had the separate bedroom.
Why'd the boys get a separate bedroom?
That's mean, isn't it? Yeah. But then you didn't have a bathroom either, so the tin bath was kept under the stairs, and that came out once a week. And Dad went in it first, followed by Mum, and then followed by all the kids. And then toilet was down the bottom of the garden. And it wasn't your own toilet. You shared it with everyone on your block.
Oh! Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
I remember my grandmother telling me that she used to sleep with all her sisters. And she used to always get into bed first so she could be next to the wall, so she wouldn't be one of the ones squished in the middle or being pushed off the end of the bed. So they did used to just sleep, you know, in the same room.
Well, we were talking about Victorian age, but apparently Britain hasn't changed.
What do you mean? We still live like that, Christina. Early. Sorry.
Everyone knows who we are. What are you kidding?
Nobody cares. It's true. Have you not noticed the chamber pot in your flat?
Okay, I'm going to ask another question now. Is there something you wanted to say, Jen? Because your thing kept flickering, but then we kept cutting you off.
No, I'm sure I was so fascinated by all of this, and then we went off on tangent with chamber pots, and I thought, I have nothing to add to this.
The railway features quite heavily in Sherlock Holmes's adventures. So why were the Victorians so enthusiastic about train travel?
For Sherlock Holmes, I think the one great attraction with train travel is speed. It allows him to get across the country really quickly if he has like a murder or something to solve, or a disappearance like in the Adventure of the Primary School. It gives him that element of speed. He can get there as fast as possible. The amount of times that the railway gets used in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories is really quite amazing. I think if you look it up on the internet, someone has actually counted the number of times a train makes an appearance in Arthur Conan Doyle's work.
Oh, blimey.
It reflects a general enthusiasm that the Victorians had for the railways. They absolutely loved the idea. If you look at how fast they expanded the railways, in 1850 there were 10,000 miles of railway track in the country. And that's in England, which is a fairly small compared to the States, for instance. I mean, it's
most states are.
But even that wasn't enough. So by 1901, they'd expanded it to 35,000 miles of track and 9,000 new stations. I mean, that's far more than we've got at the moment.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And everything would have gone...
Well, a lot of the stations haven't changed.
So. Some of them have changed. A lot of the stations,
especially if you go up north.
Yeah, the further out of London you go, and the more rural you go, the more the stations have pretty much stayed the same. I mean, there were some changes. Because there wasn't the road network that we have today, I mean, the first motorways didn't arrive until, the 1950s, 1960s. The fastest way to get from A to B for anything, so the postal service, freight and passengers, was on a train, because the only other options you had were the canals or the roads, and roads in Britain have never been particularly fantastic. Passengers can travel on a train for the first time in the 19th century. Prior to that, all you had was a stagecoach, and a lot of stagecoach companies actually really resented the railways. They didn't like the idea at all, but people took to it, and the rail network grew to the point where it even had its own police force, which was the British Transport Police. Interestingly, the British Transport Police never feature in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories.
Huh.
They never consulted Sherlock Holmes, which if you go onto the British Transport Police website, I really recommend doing this because it's hysterical. they've got a page in their history of the British Transport Police section of their website, which discusses Sherlock Holmes's interaction with the staff of the British Railways and the British Transport Police. And it's great. It's written as if he was like a real character. The author of the piece, who is an ex-British Transport Police officer, says that the British Transport Police are in fact quite proud of their record of never having had to consult Sherlock Holmes, unlike the dullards at Scotland Yard. But they did tackle some pretty high-profile murder cases, the British Transport Police. The particular one which you can read about at the moment because there's a new book out on it is the murder of Thomas Briggs, which took place on an evening train, I think it was the 9:45 to Hackney or something like that, in 1864, where Thomas Briggs's hat played a crucial role in the solving of the crime.
His hat?
His hat, yes. And the book is by an author called Kate Culkern, and she's a historian, and her book is called Mr. Briggs's Hat. And it's all about British Transport Police's first murder case. But unfortunately, the fascination that Victorians had with the railways didn't last very long, due to mainly technological advances. So trains changed. They became electrically and powered and diesel-powered. So steam trains became obsolete because it was an industry that was not making a lot. Well, it wasn't making a lot of money at all. It was making huge losses. The British government instituted a report, which was done by a guy called Dr. Beeching, who is not everyone's favourite guy. And his report suggested that they slimmed down the railways quite substantially. And a lot of the branch lines and small lines were absolutely demolished. They got rid of all the stations, they got rid of all the lines, particularly in the southwest of England. If you go down there now, virtually none of the railway that they had in the 19th century is in existence anymore. You can't get to the places that Holmes and Watson would have known on their way to Baskerville Hall, for instance. You can't get to them on the railways anymore. They've only got a couple of main lines left.
Interestingly enough, actually, I'm at my parents' house right now, and if I look out my window, just behind our house is an old railway line from the Victorian period that all sleepers have been taken away, but you can still see the platform, so that is one of those abandoned railways that isn't used anymore.
Yeah, a lot of them have been turned into footpaths and bridle paths.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, so a lot of them are being reclaimed, though, by heritage railway companies who've bought steam trains and what have you and are reopening the lines.
Well, if you get your hold of a railway sleeper as well, they're worth quite a lot of money. So if you find one. It's my advice to you.
This crime doesn't pay.
Stealing railway sleepers, it's a crime.
This has been PA from the British Railway. Yes.
We apologise.
But not really. But the other thing that we lost as well was a lot of the stations. A lot of the branch line stations are gone completely. A lot of the rural stations are much smaller than they... Smaller. The ones that we've got left in London are nothing like what they were. For instance, Euston Station, which was the oldest station in London. It was built in 1837. And if you look at any paintings or photographs of it before it was knocked down, it's an absolutely beautiful building. They painted stars on the ceiling of the Ticket Hall. It was an absolutely gorgeous building. And it was knocked down and replaced with the one that we've got today, which is horrendous.
Going back to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, how accurate was his portrayal of policing in the 19th century?
Police forces tend to get a bit of a bad stick in detective fiction.
Yes.
But then you can't have a great detective like Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or Jane Marple if the police aren't a bit shit. Saggy around the middle. Yeah. I wasn't going to say the word shit, but as you brought it up.
This is the internet.
We can say whatever we want.
You could say that there is a certain amount of artistic license in what Conan Doyle and Christie and other writers like them did with the police force. But there is also very real evidence that the British police force, in Arthur Conan Doyle's time, certainly, didn't have that much of a good reputation anyway. They hadn't been around for that long, certainly in London. There was a very concerted movement against a police force during the sort of late 18th, early 19th century. People didn't think it was a good idea. The whole idea of this, the state's law enforcement was thought to be against civil liberty and against private freedom. They didn't like the idea.
Private freedom to be murdered.
Not only private freedom to be murdered. We go on today about the Surveillance Society and how we don't like the idea of CCTV. And
it's everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
By the CCTV camera.
And it was a similar feeling, I think, against the idea of the formation of a police force in the sort of 18th and 19th centuries. People just weren't comfortable with the idea that these random strangers in uniform would have power over them to arrest them and take them off the street or search them or whatever. Mm. That all changed, though, at the start of the 19th century. There was a very famous case in London, which is called the Ratcliffe Highway Murders, which occurred in 1811 over the Christmas holidays. And the Ratcliffe Highway is a road in the East End. It's now just called the Highway, I believe. It's not far from the Commercial Road. It runs along a ridge of high ground that borders what was Wapping Marshes, which is how it gets its name. It's called the Highway. And it was one of the principal thoroughfares of London's dockyards. You know, all around Wapping was where all the ships used to come in. During Christmas 1811, two families, one was that of a shopkeeper and the other one was a pub landlord, were hacked to death in their homes late at night. After they'd shut up shop, basically. And among the victims was the shopkeeper's young baby boy, who was 3.5 months old.
My God.
He was murdered in his crib. The investigation, if you ever read anything about the investigation into the Ratcliffe Highway murders, from a 21st century point of view, you know, anything about forensic science or criminal law, it will drive you absolutely insane with frustration.
Kind of like the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah. P.D. James actually wrote...
Great, thanks for bringing that up.
Come on, it was so obvious. Sorry, continue.
P.D. James actually wrote a very good book on it in the 1970s with another author, a historian called T.A. Critchley. And the book is called The Mall and the Pear Tree. And it's very good read. P.D. James went through the whole investigation for her book. And some of the things that you read will absolutely make your jaw drop to the floor. When the murders were initially discovered, rather than shutting up the buildings or preserving the crime scene, the public were allowed to come in.
Oh, my God.
So the local parish constable would supervise people as they came in to view... Not only the scene of the crime, but the body is actually in situ, would have been left
just
there.
So someone off the street could wander in, like, I want to see a dead body today.
Not so much that, but when well, the was first discovered, yes.
I kind of wonder if you, like, how long, that... you know, without TV would we resort to this kind of thing for entertainment? Without 2 days without the internet, right, a crime scene, where is it?
But in the Ratcliffe Highway murders, these were people who were killed indoors in their own homes. And the public were just let in. And because of the system at the time, there was no Metropolitan Police Force, there was no City of London Police. What you had was a series of night watchmen and parish constables. So they were employed by the parish church to patrol the streets at night, and their basic job was to stop people breaking into houses. That was essentially all they did. There was no detective force, unless you count the Bow Street Runners, who'd been formed by Henry Fielding. They did get involved in the case, as did two parish councils, the Home Office, and because of where the Ratcliffe Highway murders took place, they also involved the River Police. No one talks to each other. Everyone's collecting different bits of evidence. Informants are going to different agencies to give their evidence. And because they all hate each other, they're not sharing this information.
Oh, dear.
There was never anyone actually put on trial for the Ratcliffe Highway murders. They did have a prime suspect who actually committed suicide in prison, although in P.D. James's book she questions whether or not it was a suicide. And the outcry over never having caught someone for these murders sort of gave the Home Office a bit of a kick up the arse. And in 1829, 18 years later, they passed the Metropolitan Police Act. And this allowed them to form a police and a detective force for Greater London, which numbered 1,000 officers. And it also provided for a City of London Police. The City of London is the old medieval city, and it has its own police force. I think it's probably the smallest, or not the smallest, then one of the smallest police forces in the country. So, and it also has its own Lord Mayor. So
because the City of London is the old Roman rolls.
Yeah. So the Lord Mayor of London is not the Mayor of London. And the Mayor of London is not the Mayor of the City of London. Anyway.
Boris Johnson's confused enough anyway, like, why would you need to make him more confused? That poor man!
Anyway, so they formed the Metropolitan Police under the Metropolitan Police Act. And the Metropolitan Police, because of where their offices were, became known as Scotland Yard. But even with this police force in place, they still had an issue with how detectives went about investigating crimes. Up until probably the early 20th century, the vast bulk of criminal cases were prosecuted on one form of evidence, and that was eyewitness testimony. And that had been the same pretty much since the law began in this country, so going back right to the early medieval period. It was very difficult for police officers to get their heads around the idea of forensic evidence and preserving crime scenes. Sherlock Holmes comes along in the sort of late 19th century. He really was someone who was quite different in the way that he investigated stuff.
Was Arthur Conan Doyle looking ahead when he came up with ways in which Sherlock Holmes solved crimes, or was he just looking at the technology that was already beginning in the Victorian times?
Arthur Conan Doyle, we all know, trained as a doctor, so he was fairly familiar with all of the techniques that were around, I think, at the time, and they were just beginning. So Sherlock Holmes, while he wasn't an inventor as such of these methods, he was certainly at the cutting edge of forensic science. In fact, in 2002, the Royal Society of Chemistry actually awarded Sherlock Holmes a posthumous fellowship for his contribution to science.
A posthumous, and oh, you're not a real person, but we're going to give it to you anyways.
But he is the only director to have ever been awarded a fellowship of the Royal Society of Chemistry.
Isn't he special?
But in Arthur Conan Doyle's and Sherlock Holmes's lifetime, they would have seen a lot of developments that came particularly out of the medical field. So, for instance, in the 19th century, chemists and biologists learn how to tell the difference between animal blood and human blood. They learn how to tell the difference between different types of blood. They also come up with a formalised method for the forensic autopsy, which wasn't sort of really thought about much. They also, in the legal sphere start using photography, which has really come on sort of in that period. So the mugshot gets invented, became an accepted way of identifying someone. Prior to that, they'd used a technique which is, I often can't pronounce, which is anthropometry, which was the very precise measurement of body parts, so length of limbs, facial features and that sort of thing. But it was, as you can imagine, prone to error. So they eventually alighted on fingerprints as a way of identifying criminals. But the one area that really took off, if you like, in terms of forensic science in the 19th century was the area of toxicology, which is detecting a poison in either a substance or within the human body. Poisoning was a great pastime.
You make it sound like everybody did it on a Sunday afternoon. Oh, I'm tired of speaking to the neighbours. Get the poison out, Henry.
For a start off, lots of things that we would consider to be very dangerous these days were quite freely available over the counter at the chemist, as long as you were willing to sign the poison's book. The poison's book. So you could go in and buy arsenic if you wanted it.
And no one would question you.
They would question you, but if you said, I'm just going to kill some rats. No.
AKA my husband.
Yeah. Otherwise known as Charlie next door. Then you could happily sell you the arsenic. In fact, arsenic was so popular as a poison in the 17th century, particularly in France for some reason. I don't know what it was about French men, but they got bumped off rather than not. It became known as inheritance powder. So wives that wanted to get rid of husbands that they didn't love, other people that just wanted to get rid of a wealthy male relative in order to inherit, had access to a whole network of professional poisoners who would not only advise you on the best way to slip it to your victim, but they would also provide you with the raw materials. And there were a number of very high profile cases in France in the 17th century of these poisoners who all women for some reason.
This could be an amazing book, I feel, coming on.
An amazing sideline, like second career. Actually burnt at the stake for these crimes.
They weren't very nice.
This is France, you know. Yeah. I thought they still burned people at the stake in France.
It's like the British still use chamber pots.
We're learning lots of truths about Europe now.
So, arsenic, very popular poison, and it was one of the first poisons that they actually developed a definitive test for in the 19th century. So they looked at different ways of coming up with a chemical test. And a British chemist called James Marsh actually came up with one in 1832, which was named the Marsh test after him. And it was used in a very famous French case again, which is called the Lafarge case. And it's quite an interesting case. Madame Lafarge was a very wealthy young lady in her own right, and was married off to this man who claimed to be equally wealthy and who told her he had his own castle, which turned out to be a rat-infested shack. So obviously she was a bit annoyed by this.
She did the very French thing she could do. She poisoned him.
And the Marsh test was used to prove that he died of arsenic poisoning. Madame Lafarge was actually convicted of the crime, although her sentence was commuted from death to life imprisonment, and there's some conjecture about whether or not she actually did it. That for a long time the Marsh test was the definitive test for arsenic, and it was followed in the 1840s by a development of another test for prussic acid, and in the 1850s for a test for strychnine. But perhaps one of the more famous cases that Arthur Conan Doyle would have been aware of, because it involved perhaps his tutor, was a case called the Chanterelle case, which involves another French person. So the crime actually took place in Scotland, which happened in 1878. Eugene Chanterelle was a Scottish medical student who dropped out of school. He married his sweetheart, Elizabeth, although why she consented to marrying him, I don't know, because he would often brag in public that he had enough medical know-how to bump her off and no one would ever know.
That's not something you openly
try.
No, not an intelligent guy, obviously, either. No. And unfortunately, he chose to commit his crime in Scotland in the 19th century, at a time when Scotland had some of the best medical practitioners in the world. What he did was he slipped his wife, Elizabeth, a fatal dose of opium, but not content with that, he also left the gas pipe open in her bedroom and gassed her.
Wow. this guy was ambitious.
She was found by her maid in the morning. She was actually still alive when she was found. And maid obviously could smell the gas in the room. She called a doctor. And Elizabeth was moved to a hospital where she eventually died. But the doctor who attended her, who wasn't her own GP, actually had the forethought to take a sample of her vomit. She'd been sick during the night. And it's very good that he did, because when it was analysed, it was found to contain a lethal dose of opium, which they possibly wouldn't have detected otherwise. And along with the testimony from a gas fitter who testified that the gas line had definitely been tampered with, old Chantrelle got hanged.
Good catch.
But the toxicologist that carried out the tests in the Chantrelle case was a guy called Dr. Henry Littlejohn, who was a consulting toxicologist and also colleague of Dr. Joseph Bell, who was a very famous doctor and was also Conan Doyle's tutor. So it's quite likely that Conan Doyle...
And for Sherlock Holmes.
Sweet. Thank you very much, Trudy.
That's all right.
Using your brain and intellect. And
yeah, it doesn't get exercised very often.
Smart
it needs
shit.
Help. Yeah.
So going off on that, obviously the Granada television series makes painstaking detail to make it as authentic as possible to the stories and obviously to the time period. I'm going to let you guys go off on that because I know you're like really excited about this. And I've only seen Hound of the Baskervilles Granada, so I actually don't know anything about it. So indulge me.
For someone that has never watched the Granada series, which episodes would the rest of you recommend?
Okay, well, I've got my box set here now.
Oh, she's well prepared.
Yeah, I took it from the shop. So, like Jen said before, or was it Trudy? I don't know. Priory School is definitely one that I would recommend. One that I also love very dearly and that I watch every Christmas is The Blue Carbuncle. As a story, is completely preposterous and ridiculous, full of coincidences, but it's wonderful. It may ruin the Christmas Carol, Go Rest You Merry Gentlemen for you. For a couple of days, but it's lovely. I mean, just the guy who plays Shannara Peterson is brilliant, and it's lovely. It's a lovely Christmas story. It's my kind of Christmas story, and so I definitely recommend that one. Yeah, that is actually possibly my favorite of the Granada ones. And one that I really really like because it's just so Sherlock Holmesy as well is The Musgrave Ritual. But if you have 45 minutes to spare, watch Blue Carbuncle. If you've got a bit more time than that, watch Priory School and watch Musgrave Ritual. And if by that time you are not hooked, then there is something to do.
The other two that I would add to that list would be The Redheaded League, which of course is perfect for you.
I love Ginger.
And Dying Detective, which I got told off recommending on the internet the other day because some fans are actually distraught all the way through it. But I love it. It's an excellent episode, I think.
I've not seen that one, but I think the Redheaded League is definitely one of my favorite ones just because it's just so much fun.
I mean, that laugh that Holmes and Watson share at the beginning at the expense of Redheaded Man is just comedy gold. It's brilliant.
That's the one thing that I like about... The dying detective is Watson in that episode because Holmes is absolutely impossible. You know, he's lying on the couch dying of some hideous tropical disease and he refuses to let Watson help him and instead sends for a rival doctor. I don't want to give too much plot away because I've seen it. And just Watson's distraught state all the way through it. It's lovely.
Angst. We love angst.
The one that I just watched, finished watching the other night, was The Hound of the Baskervilles. And I'm bringing it back only because that's the only one Christina's watched, too. because it's my favorite story, I was kind of anxious to see how they had adapted it. And they cut out a little bit of the story. That's for time purposes and continuity, I'm sure. But what freaked me out was the whatever thing that they did to make the dog look like it was glowing in the dark. Was just
that
so
super
creepy.
Scary, isn't it? I know.
I get that, you know, for when the series was made, there's obviously only so many technological advances made in television to make that dog look scary. But it was almost like green slime you would have found in a Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, wow.
The guy played Sir Henry was very attractive. The entire time I'm watching, like, hi.
And that's how much attention Curly have paid to Dylan. Yeah. The whole episode.
The guy that played Henry Baskerville in the Granada version. I can only remember Christopher Lee from the Hammer version. So every time I think of Henry Baskerville, I think of Christopher Lee, and it's just...
No, no, he has very nice hair.
Really?
Rather impressive sideburns, but really good hair.
He also had the world's most outrageous tie at the beginning.
Yes, fabulous.
I was actually just thinking of one of the other recent ones that I watched was The Devil's Foot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear God.
It was creepy. And I hadn't read the story yet, so I wasn't even familiar with the plot until I watched the episode. So I was slightly creeped out by it.
It's very 80s, though, in what it does, I think. I have to confess, I don't really like it too much, and that's because, well, Holmes gets high on this unknown drug, and which is possibly fatal, and, you know, it's just very, very casual about it. Watson's completely outraged, and Holmes, what the heck are you doing here? And also the dream sequence, I think, is just, it is, you look at it and you just think, yeah, 80s.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
There's another episode like that as well, isn't it, which was their adaptation of The Noble Bachelor, which I think they called The Eligible Bachelor, didn't they?
Yes.
Which is very, very weird.
And it's the same sort of thing, because the answer to the case comes to Holmes in this kind of dream sequence, and that's just excuse me, no, that's not how you do it. That's not how it goes.
This isn't how it is supposed to be.
Guy Ritchie and Mark Gatiss, take note. Mama Linda says you cannot do dream sequences.
What did you like most about the Granada series? Like, what, like, specific things?
Jeremy Brett.
Same here. Jeremy Brett is just awesome.
Yeah, hands down. I think it's his portrayal of Holmes that's just, it's fantastic. In such a way that what he does is what you're picturing in your head when you're reading the stories. He gets it. He totally gets it.
Yeah, that was what drew me in first when I watched them the first time around. I say the first time around, I've watched them a good many times, but I've recently rewatched them after not watching them for some time. And what I pay real attention to now is the chemistry that Jeremy Brett and David Burke had, and then later Jeremy Brett and Edward Hardwick, because he took over from David Burke as Watson. And it's, I don't think I've seen that kind of on-screen chemistry between two actors that often at all. And it's kind of fascinating to also watch the contrast between David Burke and Edward Hardwick, because they play Watson quite differently. They have quite a different approach to the character, and the dynamics between Holmes and Watson change according to who's playing him. And right now, if you asked me if I had a favorite of the two, I probably couldn't even give an answer, because they both bring such different aspects to the character of Watson. And also, if you read up on this, the history of it a bit, the actors were quite close friends in real life, and I think that's that transports to the screen. If you look at all the stuff that they went through together, if you look at some of the later episodes, it's a marvel that they actually exist.
The one thing I like about Jeremy Brett's portrayal of Holmes, and it's probably a mixture of the writing of the series and Jeremy Brett's character, is that he plays it with a lot more humour than you see in subsequent portrayals. Benedict Cumberbatch's Holmes doesn't have the sort of sense of humour that Holmes of the books had, and neither does Robert Downey Jr.'s.
He's a bit cheeky, though. I rewatched the first episode recently, and I think a lot of people forget that, like, he is quite cheeky, Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes. Like, if you watch some of the things he says, he's got this kind of... It's not the same, though. I know what you mean. It's not the same kind of levity that you find in the books.
It's more of a sarcastic edge.
Yeah.
Where Jeremy Brett's is a lot... It's almost silly. He has no problem laughing, and his laugh is just enough to get you to giggle because he's so funny.
There was a moment in The Hound of the Baskervilles when he was, like, making the soup, and he was trying to get Watson to eat it, and I was dying laughing. He's like, Holmes, it's disgusting. He's like,
yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why Blue Carbuncle is one of my favorites because Holmes laughs so much in it.
He's genuinely having a good time.
I think that's the one thing that a lot of the adaptations of Holmes have overlooked, that Granada got right, was Holmes' sense of humour.
You guys who have seen it, have you got a favourite moment? Not a favourite episode, a favourite moment.
Mine would be from The Adventure at the Priory School, when Holmes confronts him for the first time about his apparent reluctance to allow Holmes to investigate. And when Holmes is talking to him about, you know, this is your son, you know, regardless of whether he's your younger son, he's not your favourite, whatever, mm-hmm. he's still your son. And it's just that sense that Holmes has compassion for the boy, and yet to a certain extent he understands the boy as well. He's a boy who's been sent away to boarding school because of his frosty relationship with his parent, and there's very much the sense that Sherlock Holmes empathizes with that.
Yeah, that is a good scene. I've got a silly one, and then I've got another compassionate one. The compassionate one, actually, when watching the Hound of the Baskervilles, that moment when they're bringing I can't think of her name, the woman, she's just been tied up, and he's walking down the stairs with her, and she's, you know, she looks like she's going to collapse, and, you know, Holmes at least realizes that, and he's supporting her and checking her and making sure she's okay, whereas that's normally kind of Watson's area, which, you know, was kind of fun, you know, nice to see. My other favorite moment, and partly because it's, I turned it into a GIF, and it's been blowing around Tumblr, like, it's that scene in the Redheaded League when, you know, when Holmes or when Watson looks at Holmes as the guy who's come there is telling him this ridiculous story of copying out the words in the encyclopedia. And they just share this look of, OK, we just don't laugh. Don't. Oh, my God. Oh, we've got to laugh now.
It's really funny.
But it's just a really great moment because you see the relationship between Holmes and Watson. They're having an entirely nonverbal conversation, and then they just explode because they've reached the point where they just can't contain it any longer because it's the funniest thing they've ever heard.
My favorite emotional one is from The Speck of Band when they're in the house opposite and watching, and Holmes is lighting his cigarette, and they're just in the dark, and he says something along those lines, thank you very much for you know, for doing this for me, for being here with me at this moment, because I realize, you know, we're putting ourselves in danger here. And I don't know what it is about it, but you just get a sense that, you know, they've been hanging around each other for a long time, and Holmes keeps just getting himself into these ridiculous, dangerous situations, which for himself, probably he doesn't even mind, but he does mind that it's Watson who's there with him. Like you just said, you get the you get a side of great relationship, this great friendship that they have. The silly one, the favourite one that I have is the couch jumper. It has to be the couch jumper. I think that's also
that's a good one.
Those reminded me of another one, which is from The Dying Detective. Holmes is on his absolute last legs, and the doctor that he's made Watson send for is on his way, and this doctor happens to be a prime suspect in a murder, and Watson's very reluctant, obviously, to let him treat Holmes. Watson is standing there protesting with Holmes, who's lying on the sofa, that he refuses to leave his side. Holmes just shouts at him, "If you love me, you'll hide." And immediately, without another word, Watson goes and hides behind a chest of drawers. Right, I just love that.
The power of guilt.
He employs it well.
So this is Big Sheep Babe signing off. Thank you so much, Trudy.
Bye.
You're waving again. No one can see you.
Remember to say goodbye this time.
And episode 4 will appear sometime in July. I don't know when. Be patient. Cool.
Oh, and that's it, everybody. That's a wrap.
Yay!
Bye.
If you want to read anything that Trudy was talking about, there is now a reading list up on our blog, which is bakerstreetbabes.blogspot.com. You can also look at a companion piece of an 1892 Strand magazine sent to us by the lovely Lindsay Fay. You can check all that stuff up on our website. We'll also be having a new website soon. It will be beautiful. It will be lovely. It will appear sometime in July and maybe August. Who knows?
A reminder that you can help save Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home in Hindhead, Surrey by supporting the Undershaw Preservation Trust. It was at Undershaw that he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Return of Sherlock Holmes, and entertained many notable people, including Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, J.M. Barrie, the creator of Peter Pan, and the young Virginia Woolf. Today, Undershaw stands sorrowfully empty, neglected, and vandalized. Waverly Borough Council have granted the owners planning permission to carve up the literary historic house into three flats, with five more homes built on its side. Modern townhouses, or maintained as the single dwelling that Conan Doyle designed and had built. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is vigorously working towards the latter. And you can help by visiting www.saveundershaw.com, as well as following them on Twitter and joining their Facebook campaign. Thank you.
And now, it's news time.
We're too lazy to follow Team Sherlock around Wales, but you can follow Sherlockology on Twitter. They do the hard work. We just report it with funny 80s news music. So far for episode 3, The Reichenbach Fall, filming is mainly going on in Cardiff, but the team has been reported in Newport and at Tredegar House. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Sorry, Wales. The Newport scene was in a cemetery with the characters of Mycroft, Sherlock, and John. Doom. Probably. They will probably show up in London quite soon. You can now vote for Sherlock and Benedict Cumberbatch in the National TV Choice Awards. Voting is now open, and the winners will be announced in September. You can vote at www.tvchoicemagazine.co.uk/awards/2011/vote. New images of Martin Freeman as Bilbo Baggins have appeared in Entertainment Weekly and Empire Magazine. You can check out the large-footed and very curly Bilbo pics online at their websites. Rupert Graves can be seen in Scott and Bailey as the character Nick Savage in the first 3 episodes, and is rumored to be attached to a thriller called Abraham's Daughter as a character named William. We will give you more info when it appears. Don't forget, Andrew Scott and Lewis Breasley are still making headlines in the West End in London, in Emperor and Galilean, and The Government Inspector. If you're in the London area or you can get to London, you should go and see the shows. They're absolutely fabulous. The Government Inspector does only run until July 9th, so time is running out. In terms of Third Star, it's being really, really well received in the United States, which is absolutely fabulous. Screenings are going until July 9th in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, and Miami as a part of From Britain with Love, along with live and virtual webcast and conversations with talents from the film. You can follow Third Star to learn more about these at Twitter at This is Third Star. You can also look online at thirdstarfilm.com to see where it's playing in a theater near you. There has been a DVD release date. It will be in September. The DVD will be region 2, so that will be only for the UK. But if you have a region 3 DVD player, or you can play it on your laptop if you are not from the United Kingdom.
Hello and welcome again to Kaffa's Reading Corner. I will be continuing this week with the rest of The Beryl Coronet. "I feel that time is of value," said he. "That is why I have hastened here when the police inspector suggested that I should secure your cooperation. I came to Baker Street by the underground, and hurried from there on foot, for the cabs go slowly through this snow. That is why I was so out of breath, for I am a man who takes very little exercise. I feel better now, and I will put the facts before you as shortly and yet as clearly as I can. It is, of course, well known to you that in a successful banking business as much depends upon our being able to find remunerative investments for our funds as upon our increasing our connection in the number of our depositors. One of our most lucrative means of laying out money is in the shape of loans, where the security is impeachable. We have done a good deal in this direction during the last few years, and there are many noble families to whom we have advanced large sums upon the security of their pictures, libraries, or plate. Yesterday morning I was seated in my office at the bank, when a card was brought to me by one of the clerks. I started when I saw the name, for it was none other than—well, perhaps even to you I had better say no more. It was a name which is a household word all over the earth, one of the highest, noblest, most exalted names in England. I was overwhelmed by the honour and attempted, when he entered, to say so, but he plunged at once into business with the air of a man who wishes to hurry quickly through a disagreeable task. "Mr. Holder," said he, "I have been informed that you are in the habit of advancing money." "The firm do so when the security is good," I answered. "It is absolutely essential to me," said he, "that I must have £50,000 at once. I could, of course, borrow so trifling a sum 10 times over from my friends, but I much prefer to make it a matter of business, and to carry out the business myself. In my position, you can readily understand that it is unwise to place oneself under obligations." "For how long, may I ask, do you want this sum?" I asked. "Next Monday I have a large sum due to me, and I shall then most certainly repay you what you advance, with whatever interest you think it right to charge, but it is very essential to me that the money should be paid at once." "I should be happy to advance it without further parley from my own private purse," said I, "were it not that the strain would be rather raw than it could bear. If, on the other hand, I am to do it in the name of the firm, then in justice to my partner I must insist that, even in your case, every business-like precaution should be taken." "I should much prefer to have it so," said he, rising up a square, black morocco case which he had laid beside his chair. "You have doubtless heard of the Beryl coronet." "One of the most precious public possessions of the empire," said I. "Precisely." He opened the case, and there, embedded in soft, flesh-coloured velvet, lay the magnificent piece of jewellery which he had named. "There are 39 enormous beryls," said he, "and the price of the gold case is incalculable. The lowest estimate would put the worth of the coronet at double the sum which I have asked. I am prepared to leave it with you as my security." I took the precious case into my hands, and looked in some perplexity from it to my illustrious client. "You doubt its value?" he asked. "Not at all. I only doubt the propriety of my leaving it. You may set your mind at rest about that. I should not dream of doing so were it not absolutely certain that I should be able in 4 days to reclaim it. It is a pure matter of form. Is the security sufficient?" "Ample. You understand, Mr. Holder, that I am giving you a strong proof of the confidence which I have in you, founded upon all that I have heard of you. I rely upon you not only to be discreet and to refrain from gossip upon the matter, but, above all, to preserve this coronet with every possible precaution, because I need not say that a great public scandal would be caused if any harm were to befall it. Any injury to it would be almost as serious as its complete loss, for there are no beryls in the world to match these, and it would be impossible to replace them. I leave it with you, however, with every confidence, and I shall call for it in person on Monday morning." Seeing that my client was anxious to leave, I said no more, but calling for my cashier, I ordered him to pay over £50,000 notes. When I was alone once more, however, with the precious case lying upon the table in front of me, I could not but think with some misgivings of the immense responsibility which had been entailed upon me. There could be no doubt that, as it was a national possession, a horrible scandal would ensue if any misfortune should occur to it. I already regretted having ever consented to take charge of it. However, it was too late to alter the matter now, so I locked it in my private safe and turned once more to my work. When evening came, I felt that it would be imprudence to leave so precious a thing in the office behind me. Bankers' safes had been forced before now, and why should not mine be? If so, how terrible would it be in the position I would find myself? I determined, therefore, that for the next few days I should always carry the case backwards and forwards with me, so that it might never be out of my reach. With this intention I called a cab and drove out to my house at Streatham, carrying the jewels with me. I did not breathe freely until I had taken it upstairs and locked it in the bureau of my dressing room. That's all for this week, I'm afraid. We'll find out what happens to the Beryl coronet when we get next week's episode.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
Martin's got my heart in his hands, took me by surprise. I thought that I'd be into his friend, but then I saw those eyes. Close, Martin. patience for me. I buy him records and jumpers and jam. He says it's embarrassing. Martin, you're right, but I am smitten. Your feelings are valid and all, but you're cute as a kitten. Smile.